Commencement du monde. Un événement du monde. All you have made requires a coin deposit. Please hang up, check the instructions on the payphone for the appropriate rate, and dial your call again.
Understood, but did it know? And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
Here in the flesh.
Exactly. And out there in Signal Land, we have Rob T, Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
You do. Good evening.
I don't know why you sound like you're in space, but fine. Okay. Rob, I understand you just went through some ordeal. You want to share what's going on?
Oh, yeah. It was an interesting day this morning. At my place of work, which is up in the Morningside Heights neighborhood of Manhattan, my workplace was evacuated a little after 11 this morning.
What did you do?
It wasn't me, not this time. There was a gas problem, and not the kind for which you dissolve a spoonful of baking soda in half a glass of water. There was a major high-pressure gas leak out in the street. It was a strange experience. Everyone is fine.
Hang on. You were in your place of work.
Yes.
There's a high-pressure gas leak outside, so mm-hmm. they evacuated you outside.
Yes, they did.
Uh-huh.
And this was a good decision, because just before we were evacuated, a bunch of us in the office, and I was on a higher floor of a building in the area, and a bunch of us started sort of scrunching our eyes at each other and going, "Does it smell like gas in here?" And it did, in fact, smell like gas in there. And that's when the building's alarm system went off, and we had been hearing a noise, a loud noise, sort of like a whooshing noise that would sound like maybe a malfunctioning air conditioner or an air compressor, maybe in another room. And we were hearing this noise and wondering what it was. We start smelling gas, and we were advised by our building's alert system to evacuate immediately. We took the stairs, and we noticed as we were going down the stairs that the sound was getting louder, to the point where when we got out onto the street, we were deafened. The sound was intense. It was painful. Standing right next to one another, we couldn't speak to one another. You could see lips moving, but not hear anything. And we just started walking away from the building as directed down the street. And we were up in the 120s, which was right where this leak was taking place. And we ended up walking all the way down to 115th Street and a few blocks over. And we could still hear the noise, but then we stopped smelling the gas and, you know, just hung out basically by Morningside Park and regrouped for a while. The area was very noisy. There were streams of confused people just sort of looking around. There were schools in the area, as well as places of work and residence. And everyone was fine, and apparently there, I don't think any injuries have been reported. The problem has since been capped off, but this turned out to be just some construction workers hit a high-pressure gas line and forced basically the entire neighborhood to be evacuated. It was interesting. It was a bit frightening in the moment, because when you live in the city and go outside and there is noise that you cannot identify and that is hurting you, that is of concern. A lot of us have been through things that this might remind us of, but it ended up just being sort of a strange way to get out of work. But eventually we were sent home and went on with our days.
Wow. Okay. Well, that sounds like a bit of an adventure. And I'm sure a lot of people on the Upper West Side are sharing your adventure right now. Maybe we can get a clip of what it sounded like by Overtime, which is at 8 o'clock on YouTube. Because I'd like to hear what that sound. You say it's like a sound like you never heard before.
It was strange. It was like being near a jet engine. It's like it would sound like things that you might have heard, but never this loud, never this painful, never this out in the street.
Wow. Okay. Well, glad you made it through whatever that was safely, not too traumatized. Boy. Okay. It's never a dull moment here in the big city. Okay. Well, you know what I'm going to say is going to seem awfully trivial and maybe even petty compared to what that's all about. I'm mad at Google again. And okay, now this time I really think I've got a good case to really complain here, because every time I make a complaint against Google, there's always somebody that pipes up and says, "Oh, it's not Google's fault. You did something wrong. You know, they did everything correctly, and you're just the poor consumer that went along for the ride. You should have known better." All right, you know, I have one of those Nest thermometers. You know where this is going. I bought the Nest thermometer a long time ago, back when the company was called Nest, before Google got its claws on it. Well, I couldn't stop that from happening.
Don't you mean Alphabet?
Oh, God.
Or were they Alphabet
at
the time?
You have to, when a company keeps adding names to their organization, they're hiding from something.
So you'd say it was called Nest before Google, the company formerly known.
Nest is innocent. I mean, Nest was innocent. They were just a company that made a good device.
I've made my point.
Then Google stepped in and said, "We want this. Here's money. Go away." And now what Google has done is given a big middle finger to everybody who bought those early thermostats by bricking them, by saying, "These aren't going to work as of October. Buy another one, and then it'll work." That's really basically what they're saying. I'll read you a story that I think kind of typifies what I'm talking about as far as apologists for Google. See if you can read into this story of bad news. You know, bad news for consumers, innocent consumers that bought something they thought was going to keep working, and see how the story kind of turns. And turns it into a good thing. Yeah, this is from Ars Technica. Google's oldest smart thermostats have an expiration date. Isn't that cute? They have an expiration date. You know, like a loaf of bread or something like that. The company has announced that the first and second generation Nest Learning thermostats will lose support in October 2025, disabling most of the connected features. Google is offering some compensation for anyone still using these devices. But there's no Google upgrade for European users. There's no upgrade at all for you guys. Okay, they're offering compensation. Doesn't that sound good? Thank you, Google. You're offering compensation. I mean, that seems like the fair thing to do. Continuing. Google is also discontinuing its only European model, and it's not planning to release another. Both affected North American thermostats predate Google's ownership of the company, which it acquired in 2014. Nest released the original learning thermostat to almost universal praise in 2011. I was part of that universal praise, with the sequel arriving a year later. Google's second-gen Euro unit launched in 2014. Since launch, all these devices have been getting regular software updates and have migrated across multiple app redesigns. However, all good things must come to an end. No, they don't. Why do all good things have to come to an end? The only reason this is coming to an end is because Google decided to kill it. There's absolutely no reason in the world to discontinue this technology that does not have any technical issues. You could easily continue the support for older products when people don't feel like getting new ones because it's not broken. All right, let me finish the story. As Google points out, yeah, because listen to them. Don't listen to anybody else. Listen to Google. As Google points out, these products have had a long life. And they're not being rendered totally inoperable. Yeah. Maybe I'm being a real sorehead here, and maybe it's not so bad. Come October 25th, 2025, these devices will no longer receive software updates or connect to Google's cloud services. That means you won't be able to control them from the Google Home app or via Assistant, or more likely Gemini by that point. Yeah, let's get back on track here, talking about all the advances and the new things. Yeah, what about this? Well, the devices will still work as a regular dumb thermostat to control temperature, and scheduling will remain accessible from the thermostat screen. So when you find yourself away on vacation, no big deal. Just either call somebody or just head home for a brief bit, run over to the thermostat and lean over it and key in all the times and temperatures that you want to enter, instead of doing that from the inconvenience of your laptop somewhere in the world. All right. So it's still going to work. Yeah, it's still going to work. Just it won't work on Google's network. I mean, yeah, it couldn't be easier, right? Just a regular dumb thermostat. Google, I bought a regular dumb thermostat to start with. I replaced it with this, and it's a lot more expensive than a dumb thermostat. And now what you've given me? is a dumb thermostat. No, I'm sorry. It's not acceptable. Anyway, the story's not over, by the way. If you have one of these units, Google will be reaching out via email with some deals to soften the blow. In the U.S., owners can get a $130 discount if they upgrade to the fourth generation Nest, which costs $280. So basically, not even half. And similar deals in Canada. So basically, yeah, give us money and we'll make this problem go away, the problem that we just caused. Now, the situation is a bit more frustrating for owners of the European thermostat. That's as critical as this article gets. Yeah, it's more frustrating for them. Google doesn't have any newer units to sell. Heating and cooling systems in Europe have various quirks that set them apart from North American systems. You get that? It's your fault. It's your fault. You have quirks. Google tried. You're not cooperating. Europe, so you're out in the cold, literally. So consequently, it's been more than a decade since Google released a smart thermostat adapted to the continent. And it never will again, the company confirms. Was that necessary? That just seems so hostile. Yeah, we will never, ever support European markets when it comes to smart thermostats. The sun will turn into a burnt out cinder first before we ever do anything like that again. That is how much we detest the European market. This move comes just weeks after Google confirmed it had discontinued the Nest Protect smoke and carbon monoxide alarm. You know, I almost bought one of those recently. Oh my God, if I had bought that, say, a couple of months ago, you think I'm mad now? A smoke and carbon monoxide alarm. Can you imagine? They're not making a replacement. basically, people are being diverted to other companies, but you still bought that, thinking it was going to keep working. Google has been shedding jobs in the platform and devices division that includes Nest. With fewer workers, it's not surprising the team would look to drop support for its older products. Thanks, Ars Technica. It's not your job to make excuses for Google. You know, the thing is, are they doing the right thing by their customers? And they clearly are not. They clearly are not. A point that is not mentioned once throughout this entire piece. You know, they decide to fire their workers, and because they fire their workers, they can't support their customers. That is a problem, all right? It's not an excuse. It's not something we have to feel sorry for them about. They made a move and it caused this reaction. And it's Google. They can afford it. I don't know if I can make it through the last two sentences of this article. And in fairness, these devices have lasted far beyond Google's measly 5-year commitment. Well, I wasn't even aware of a 5-year commitment. I never signed anything. I bought a product from a company called Nest, and Google had nothing to do with it. And now apparently they only guarantee anything for 5 years. All right. And the final sentence, so you can't say they didn't warn you. Well, they didn't warn me, and I'm stuck with a brick thermostat that only works if I do the old school turning it by hand. I will never trust Google again with anything, any kind of product that requires any kind of support. You know, I was talked into this. This is a cool device to have, and it seemed like a cool device to have. I still believe it is. And I think as hackers, we should be able to figure out a way to continue supporting these devices so that, yeah, you're not connecting to Google anymore, but you're connecting to something. And this can be a model for all kinds of other technology where a company just decides they're going to cut off any kind of support and not even think about their customers. Well, you know, I'm sick of throwing things away just because they no longer get support from these massive companies. So it's time to start thinking a little bit differently as far as these things go. Any thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this, and hopefully my sound is a little bit better at the moment. But
yeah, it's really good.
Okay, very good. Why don't we start with the issue of can hackers reverse engineer how this works? So I think we probably could. we probably could figure out how the protocol works and build something that would enable these thermostats to continue to interact with their owners in some way. But wouldn't it be funny then if that's what we did and then Google slapped us with a Digital Millennium Copyright Act suit for reverse engineering their protocols without authorization? It wouldn't be the first time the DMCA was used against hackers unfairly. But more to the point here, I think what's wrong about this entirely is that they have disabled the core functionality of the product, for which, you know, which was the sole reason you bought it, was to have this remote access to program your thermostat. I mean, that makes total sense. So when you disable that core functionality, I feel like you need to have, as a company, more of a business justification, more than rather just a business justification to do that, because you're taking a product and you're bricking it, a product that people paid a lot of money for. So you need to have some kind of technological justification for the discontinuance, and I don't see it there. I also don't even see a business judgment decision that would enable Google to say realistically with a straight face, we can't afford to support this product anymore. They just don't want to do it. They want to sell more products. So not only does this erode user trust, but I think it also undermines their environmental goals as a company, because you're bricking these products. What are people going to do with them? They're going to throw them out. And presumably these thermostats probably have something like mercury or something in them as well that you're going to have to replace. So there's an environmental impact there. But my question is, why is there no consequence whatsoever for a company like Google to do something like this? If this is done in a deceptive manner, if their reasons or their justifications don't necessarily hold water and we know that they're false, why aren't these deceptive business practices being investigated by agencies like the Federal Trade Commission? That's what they're there to do.
Well, not anymore, really. They're there to ensure profit and, destroy the environment if they can. But it's not your grandpa's FDA, let's put it that way.
Yeah, everything's become a little bit Orwellian, right? In the sense that, you know, the agencies are doing the opposite of what their names are supposed to imply. But I think, you know, putting aside for the moment the issue of whether or not a governmental regulator should step in and look into this, I also don't understand why there aren't class action lawsuits being filed against Google for the discontinuance of these types of products that wind up taking money out of the pockets of a huge number of consumers and forcing them to spend more of their money on an unnecessary product. Like, I could be wrong, but I don't think that there are too many class actions that have been filed on this particular point. Maybe it's high time there are.
I'm happy to put my name on one if something like that comes along. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, it's really remarkable how the place of appliances like this that connect to services to which we'll be beholden have become a daily part of so many people's lives. And I think it just behooves us to not only question the place of, you know, every last appliance needing to get onto the internet and connect to some service that's beyond your control and that you will likely pay for in one way or another, whether or not that's apparent. It really, I think, should make us question why we need something like this. Why do we want a washing machine that connects to the internet? It's not downloading the water from the cloud. Why do we need your toaster to, subscribe you to something? Why can't we have just a thing that does what it does and we control it and it's on the computer that's in the device and that's, you know, that we have the ability to tweak around with? You know, I think the more and more we can maybe back off from what's, you know, it, to say it in a way that works on the radio, the internet of crap. How prominent does this need to be? Is there other ways of doing things?
Well, you know, I think you raise a good point there, but it's a different point because, you know, I agree there's no reason for a refrigerator to have a social network attached to it, you know, or for a toaster to have internet access. But, you know, a thermostat you can control from far away is handy, and it was a good selling point. And to give that to people, you know, who buy it, obviously, and then take it away from them and say, buy another one because this no longer works, because we made it no longer work. It's like, you know, when we got all bent out of shape decades ago about the touch tone fee. Remember that? The phone companies would charge you for touch tones, but you still created the touch tones yourself. They just would ignore it and you were paying them to not ignore it. And eventually that went away. It took a lot of arguing, but it's the same basic mentality. And that mentality has really blossomed and come into its own. Go ahead.
I would say from a technical standpoint, there has to be ways to effectively do something like a thermostat you can control from far away without beholding you to, say, Google or somebody else and their whims on leaving a server on or off or charging you any amount of things for it. You know, we all used to have answering machines, those of us of a certain age, and there were ways to call from outside and use touch tones to reprogram them to our delight. Some of us had a lot of fun with that functionality. But my point stands that I think there should be a way to do this without running it through Google. But I think also that a company that's building that is not going to get interest from like venture capitalists who are like, how are we going to continue to capitalize on the people who have these in their house and, bleed every last cent we can out of them? And it just becomes like a fact of the way that business is done now.
Right. And I think it's also, you know, this Nest was its own thing. And then Google said, hey, we like it and we want to keep it. But my other question is, how is this different than general planned obsolescence? The difference is it's your thermostat, it's not your phone. It's your, how many times we replaced the air conditioner in this apartment?
Okay, but Gila, it doesn't work anymore. You know, it's crap, it's built to break, but this right. still works and they're just deprogramming it. So it's even worse than planned obsolescence.
You know? How?
It's planned, you know, destroying it basically. It's planned making it not work artificially. Not that it's a piece of crap that's going to stop working after a certain amount of time, you know, naturally. Nobody is saying you can't use your air conditioner anymore. You say that. You say my air conditioner, it doesn't work. I need to get another one. It's similar, but it's a different kind of problem. Kyle?
I just want to add that the design flaw, I think, at issue here is that it's reliant on a company like Google that's built in. That's the defect. Whereas an air conditioner might have some part or something that was manufactured for cost or other reasons that the marketers or the people making those decisions knew it would eventually cause the entire product to fail. Here it's simply by virtue of them controlling the type of stuff that Rob was speaking about that is not by design interoperable or portable or transferable or usable in like an API or something that allows third-party alternatives to stand in or be used instead of this company. And I would just say that I don't know what the answer is. It should have been that was supported in the first place, which kind of goes into my next point, which is I don't think compelling this organization or regulators in some way is actually going to be fruitful these days. I think that was the collective eye roll we intimated on air here at the outset of this conversation. And I really think the energy is best put to use trying to work around, in this case at least, the reliance on whatever software or servers, as we implied, to allow you to access it through your own means or your own infrastructure. And that is desirable and part of why I think a lot of people are excited about the internet of stuff and that it was the promise of the internet and being so networked that we would be able to take advantage of that network and better manage our quality of life in this case the comfort of the inside of your home. And that class, I think, is wholly missing, as Alex said, because they are conditioned to this sort of life cycle of phones and the newer, better, faster, or whatever's next is always somehow superseding the base functionality of stuff that was never broken other than it relied on these magical companies that we've put all this hype and faith into in the whole, like, sort of tech tech economy or industry we call tech, which is itself, I think, a huge fallacy. It's a hype machine. The capabilities and the magical stuff that of being able to have products that that work on the internet was never something that any of these companies that they like deserved the mantle of as they've acquired companies like Nest. They never deserved that. We always should have insisted that these things incorporate interoperability and allow us to modify things so that they don't corner products that are functioning like this with their backend and other cloud systems.
But think of the difference between, you know, a new phone has new services, new capabilities. This is a thermostat. It turns on, it turns off, it has a schedule. There's no difference between the old one and the new one. Yeah, maybe it'll look different. Maybe it'll have a couple of more features that are not necessary at all for what you want it to do. But they're just making it not work because they can. There is no reason in the world why an old thermostat wouldn't be able to work on the same network as a new thermostat. And if they make up a reason, they need to get over that reason because there is no logical reason. Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think our listeners know that I love to disagree with you whenever I possibly can, Emmanuel, but I'm on your side this time. I think there's a big difference here because you have this notion of planned obsolescence with respect to hardware, and that's where you're embedding the failure of a product into the design of the actual product itself, right? So you have, you know, Google's approach here, though, is totally different in that what we're talking about here is not necessarily product design, but service design or service obsolescence. So instead of planned obsolescence of a product, we have the disruptive service discontinuance. So this is a service obsolescence, I think, issue here where they're disabling features through some kind of back-end deprecation rather than physical degradation of the actual device here, right? So, but this has become an attack vector, I think, for all these different types of products and services that rely on anything to do with the quote-unquote cloud here. You know, we saw vehicle manufacturers like Tesla disabling certain functionalities of cars without some kind of subscription model being in place, right? These are all types of things where there's some form of servants outage or servants obsolescence that comes as a result of utilizing cloud-based services. So, you know, this is another attack vector that I think we need to think about as hackers and how we combat it. But I think that the issue that you brought up earlier was actually really smart, which is, can we do this ourselves? Because if all we're doing is essentially, all we have to do is essentially replace that cloud-type infrastructure that Google would have in place, maybe it's not as complicated as we would think.
I'm really surprised, too, that in this write-up and in their characterization of it, things like safety or security aren't even brought up. It's just this device had a good life. And my next thought is, if they're getting rid of these device and whatever teams, they're like basically letting people go, paring them down, making that less of an emphasis of their core business. What is stopping them from doing exactly the same thing to whatever product they give you a rebate for?
Nothing at all. Yeah, the same thing is going to happen. This is why I say I will never trust them again, because they're going to do it again. They're going to do it every time they can get away with it. And, you know, I don't need their support team. The device works. It's worked for over 10 years. It'll work for another 50 years, all right, assuming the planet lasts. So, you know, I don't need to call customer support to ask why the thermostat doesn't turn on. You know, it's a simple device. It should keep working. And if it actually breaks, physically breaks, then I'll get another one. You know, when something is actually physically wrong with it. But this, you know, an artificial just decommissioning, it's not right.
Oh, maybe that's what it is. The new ones actually have physical defects that will allow them to break in the future.
There you go.
See? These ones are far too elegant. Mm. and well designed because Google didn't have a hand in doing that.
Wow. You know, I think you're onto something, Carl.
That's basically what this is.
I think you're right. I think they will just die one day. It's like the toner cartridges, you know? You don't replace them, all of a sudden your printer doesn't work anymore because it ran out, because you didn't replace it by a certain time. All right, enough about this. But, you know, just in closing, I think if you have a piece of technology, like, you know, an old telephone, as long as you can keep using it, you should be able to keep using it. You know, imagine if an old rotary phone, I hate to always go back to the same example, but an old rotary phone didn't work because they decided that they don't want rotary phones to be on the network. No, it still works. It will always work. And that should be the case with any kind of technology. If you decide to use something that's older, it's up to you to keep it working, and it should keep working. And if it breaks, then you get another one. That's as simple as that. All right, Alex, you know, I understand you've been doing some research into some weird domains. I don't even know what this is all about, but there's a new .gov domain called the $1 trillion dinner. What in God's name is this all about, and how do you play into it?
This is quite an interesting story. So there were a couple of .gov domains that I had detected using the DNS intelligence system that I had put together over the last several years. And I think I talked about this a few months ago when I said I created another little bash script. I call it the little bash script that could here, that allows me to look into one particular top-level domain and compare changes between days. So I do that every day, and I look at the changes within .gov. And about a month ago, I found some really bizarre stuff being added to the .gov zone file, which is where all of the domain names in the .gov top-level domain are stored. And what I saw was a strange one called the $1 trillion dinner.gov. And then there was dinnerforamerica.gov. And then there was the trillion.gov. A couple of these, you know, really kind of odd domain names that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be part of a actual .gov kind of enterprise here. So I had decided, well, this is kind of odd, and, you know, talked to a couple people in the media about this, and, you know, nobody really knew what the hell this had to do with. Nobody had any idea about this $1 trillion dinner. And I thought it was particularly ill-fated name, because if you think about how much value this current administration has wiped out of the economy, you know, it's almost like they're celebrating the trillions of dollars that were lost. So it was pretty bad name. But it seems like what it related to was this Trump meme coin that he and some cronies had established prior to the inauguration. And these meme coins really have no particular purpose at all. They're cryptocurrencies that, you know, basically people just hold essentially for fun. Sometimes they go up in value, sometimes they don't. Most of the time they go down in value, or they go up for a little while. People pull the rug out from under them, and the holders of a massive number of these coins will sell them, leaving people with valueless digital assets. So meme coins don't have the best reputation, but there's this Trump meme coin, and it turns out, as the New York Times reported last week on, I believe it was Thursday, that there was this announcement then about this dinner that the holders of Trump meme coins were going to be eligible to attend. And if you are one of the top 200 holders of this particular meme coin, and you held it for a certain period of time, you're going to have some kind of weighted average of what you were holding. But if you were in the top 200, you would get invited to a dinner that President Trump himself would attend, which is a really kind of extraordinary thing. So there was a lot of criticism that came out about this, because it essentially could set people up for a rug pull. And it did seem like Trump had some personal financial stake in the creation of this meme coin as well. So on Thursday night, it seemed like the White House or the federal government in some capacity, I think these actually related to the Department of Commerce, that they had actually deleted from the .gov zone file dinnerforamerica.gov, the $1 trillion dinner.gov, and the trillion.gov. So they quietly tried to register these, likely in the hope that they were going to be used to try to pump this meme coin dinner using an official .gov domain. That's the hypothesis here. And then quietly decided to delete them in the hopes that nobody would notice. But I noticed. And and we got the word out. And 404 Media, Joseph Cox in particular, wrote a great write-up of this finding today. And I think had some wonderfully well-placed sources within the administration that were able to confirm this. So, yeah, it's been a pretty cool day for DNS-related findings. And I think this goes back to that old saying, right, that, you know, DNS is a source of truth.
I never heard that saying, but yeah, I guess it is. I guess it is. Well, thank you for that. Thanks for helping to reveal that. And you're continuing to look for any other .gov domains that will pop up? Anything else that's come up recently?
There's a couple of curious ones. Aha.gov was registered yesterday. AHA.gov. I don't know to what that relates. But coincidentally, the same day that the administration had deleted Dinner for America, the $1 trillion dinner, and the trillion.gov, they also deleted brainhealth.gov as well, which presumably there wasn't very much of that going around anyhow.
No, there's no need for that.
Wasn't something that was missed.
Yeah, they can't relate.
No. All right. Well, that's, I look forward to hearing more updates in the future about that. I also wanted to ask you your thoughts on another, I guess, step that's been taken in the road to fascism that we seem to be on. They're arresting judges now. A judge was arrested in Milwaukee for obstructing justice by directing an undocumented immigrant out of her courtroom through a side door and not into the hands of ICE agents. Now, maybe Alex, you could correct me here, but this was somebody who was facing charges in her courtroom, the charges of battery, some kind of altercation. Not really the issue here. The issue is who is able to do what. And the way I've always thought of it, in a courtroom, the judge pretty much has say over what happens. The judge can drop all charges on a whim if they so choose. You know, you're not supposed to do that, obviously. You're supposed to it's supposed to be based on facts, logic, that kind of thing. But in this particular case, what I wonder is, are judges supposed to be helping ICE? If they show up and say, will you help us trap this person? It just seems like that's a real conundrum for somebody who is supposed to be handing out justice to instead be laying a trap for somebody that showed up on their own accord into their courtroom and now is supposed to be cornered. It just, judges don't work for ICE. We don't work for ICE. You know, our listeners do not work for ICE. And it's my view that in many cases, working against ICE is the better choice because of some of the things that they have been responsible for in the last few weeks and months. And it's, you know, it's a really difficult situation for somebody that finds themselves like this. But arresting a judge now, that just really, it seems like a big step in a bad direction. Your thoughts?
I think it's a terrible, terrible step in absolutely a wrong-headed direction here. I think for a number of reasons. I mean, we have this notion of separation of powers between the judiciary and the executive, and the judiciary is supposed to operate independently. My understanding as well is that this warrant for the detention of this individual, this ICE warrant, was some kind of administrative warrant, not necessarily a judicial warrant. So the idea that this judge could face felony obstruction charges also raises issues of the proportionality of the charge relative
What is an administration warrant as opposed to a judicial one?
Well, it's something that wouldn't be issued by a judge, right? It could be issued by ICE itself. So this administrative warrant or something that issues very summarily as opposed to something that had, you know, issued on the basis of cause. So it seems to be, you know, somewhat of a less serious type of offense that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. But I think the real core issue that is facing not just this particular judge, but all judges, whether you're at the state level, the federal level, the appellate level, even the Supreme Court level now, is that the administration is making no bones about their intimidation of the judiciary. That's a really kind of terrifying thing, where you have one branch of government squaring off against another branch of government, both of which are enshrined in the Constitution with separation of powers to enable them to check the power of each other. So if one is trying to overpower or undermine the will of another branch of government, then we have the centralization of power in one branch that the founders and the framers of this country did not intend to have at all. Now, I think that, you know, other issues that relate to this are, if you continue to intimidate judiciary like this, and you're going to absolutely destabilize the justice system itself, because people, especially those who listen to these alt-right commentators who think that this is entirely justified, are going to start believing that judges are not impartial arbiters of the truth, but are your adversaries. And when people begin to view the judiciary as their adversaries, that's an extraordinarily dangerous idea to have in this country. And I think it is going to cause us to hurtle even more quickly towards a constitutional crisis.
Yeah, it would seem we're pretty much there. Shortly after this, the U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi, of course, defended the move, saying that Judge Hannah Dugan, her arrest sent a strong message to judges that the Trump administration will prosecute them if they obstruct justice, in her view, by escorting a criminal defendant out a back door. Again, it's her courtroom. She can escort somebody wherever she wants to escort them. They can track this person down on their own time with their own detective skills. In fact, they found the person not 2 minutes later. So the whole thing was resolved to their in their favor. But after the arrest, FBI Director Kash Patel posted on Twitter, "No one is above the law." And of course, that resulted in "Accept Trump" trending for the rest of the day on Twitter, because the hypocrisy is just astounding that they can say that with a straight face and then have a criminal in power getting away with everything and smirking about it. Meanwhile, you know, continuing with what ICE is all about, this, according to an article in New Republic, in Oklahoma City on Thursday, about 20 federal immigration agents raided the wrong home, forcing a woman out of the house with her three daughters, not even leaving them enough time to get dressed, then seized their phones, laptops, and life savings. The woman had only moved into the house 2 weeks earlier after relocating to Oklahoma from Maryland. The armed agents told the woman, identified by local TV station KFOR as Marissa, that they had a search warrant, but the named suspects on the warrant didn't live in the house and weren't connected to anyone in the family. "We just moved here from Maryland," Marissa said. "We're citizens." That's what I kept saying. "We're citizens." The agents, who identified themselves as U.S. Marshals, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and FBI agents, didn't seem to care, waking the family up, forcing them outside in their underwear, ransacking the house, and taking the family's belongings as evidence. "I told them before they left, I said, 'You took my phone, we have no money, I just moved here. I have to feed my children, I'm going to need gas money, I need to be able to get around. Like, how do you just leave me like this, like an abandoned dog?' They were very dismissive, very rough, very careless. I kept pleading. I kept telling them we weren't criminals. They were treating us like criminals. We were here by ourselves. We didn't do anything." I could go on. There's a lot more here, but these are the people that we're dealing with. So, you know, forgive me if I don't jump to attention when they ask for help. I think if they're going to do these things, they're on their own. They're on their own. And there's a whole lot of us that intend to stand in their way. All right, a little bit of humor, because I just saw this right before the show. Has to do with our friends out at Stony Brook University. The Trump administration has canceled a $4.5 million Navy grant for researchers at Stony Brook University and other institutions to study ocean conditions. But the interesting thing here is that this is one of the few times, if not the only time, that Representative Nick LaLota from Suffolk County, a Trump clone, basically, he actually stood up and is saying that, no, this isn't entirely right. He's actually sort of maybe hinting that he might think about disagreeing with something that Trump did. It's never happened before, Kyle, so don't shake your head dismissively like that. This is a big deal.
Such bravery.
He has a theory, though. He has a theory, and this is what I thought was the great part of this. He believes that the grant was erroneously canceled due to the presence of the word environment in its supporting materials. This is where we live now, that a grant can be canceled simply because it has the word environment in it. Now, basically, this is what Nick LaLota said to try and get the grant back. We want the most lethal fighting force the world has ever known. Submarine force is a large component of that, and their ability to detect undersea targets is important. This grant helps further that, helps keep our fleet safer, our strategic interests guarded. How pathetic is this? He's got to go all Rambo in order to get somebody in the Trump administration to maybe say, oh, okay, maybe the fact that it says environment doesn't mean it's totally bad. And this is some military stuff that gets me excited. This is insane. Some of these stories, The Onion was never this funny. I'm sorry, but they weren't. This reality is just, it's more than I can handle. And finally, after stranding former U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID workers, with devices holding sensitive information, the Trump administration says it will no longer physically collect their government-issued phones, laptops, and tablets. An email sent by USAID to workers on Thursday, obtained by The Verge, says the devices will be wiped remotely and then marked as disposed. Each direct hire or contractor will then be responsible for discarding the equipment. It's unclear from the email whether the decision affects people stationed abroad or only those within the continental U.S. The discarded devices are basically now trash, but maybe they're not completely trash. And also, you know, I wonder, these people who have been fired, did they even get the email? Because they don't have access to the machines or the accounts anymore. Kyle?
Yeah, and I think, like, potentially those devices could be shielded from over-the-air commands,